exclude anyone. My name's Doris. I work here in the education department. And Colin Cruz here is coming to talk this evening. He is an all-round expert on the Pre-Raphaelites, published widely. He teaches at the School of Art at the University of Wales, Aberystwyth. And he's going to be discussing this Burne Jones painting, The Sleep of Arthur in Avalon, which, this is an interesting fact, Tate could have bought for £1,000 40 years ago. But sadly, the Pre-Raphaelites were deeply unfashionable at that point. So now we've got it here on loan from a museum in Puerto Rico. Okay, now I'm going to hand over to Colin. Thank you.
Thank you, Doris. And I'm very pleased to be here today. I'm not used to microphones, but I have to use it because of the recording. So I was going to say that the Tate could have bought me for £1,000 40 years ago, but my price has gone up since then, so forget it. Anyway, one of the striking things about this painting by Burne Jones is its scale. And it's very interesting to me that this painting is this scale. And it is interesting to me because this painting has not been seen in this country for a long time. Indeed, when there was a big Burne Jones retrospective in Birmingham some 10 years ago, the painting, because of its scale and the logistics of moving it, was unable to be shown there. So this is a great opportunity for us to look at this together. Now, why is the scale otherwise important? Well, Burne Jones wasn't trained as a painter. He was trained at university and he was studying theology at Oxford. And he'd been an amateur artist. He was very drawn to the work of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Rossetti himself was only partially trained as an artist. So we have a very interesting cultural moment in British painting where two artists who are going to become amongst the most influential artists working in the 19th century are not actually either fully trained by the Royal Academy or trained at all by the Royal Academy. So I think this is a very interesting point. Now, part of this not being trained by the Royal Academy meant that Burne Jones had great difficulty in handling anatomy, certain aspects of composition. And the very first works that he did are actually very small indeed. And indeed, his work continued to be relatively small scale until about 15 years into his career, when he started producing larger works, more ambitious works, works which departed from the Pre-Raphaelites, and particularly from Dante Gabriel Rossetti's example, by not just being about the Middle Ages and certain aspects of religious, medieval culture, Catholic culture, but actually using classical subjects and allegories which were familiar from Renaissance painting. And one might almost see this as being actually in direct opposition to what the Pre-Raphaelites were interested in. But those very first works at the start of Burne Jones' career, these very small works, are often on Arthurian themes. So it's particularly interesting that in the last work, the work that was to dominate the final years of his life, that he was to go back to that Arthurian subject, but in a way that was so deeply personal that this work has become almost mythologically enwrought with his own life. He worked on it for nearly 20 years, so this is kind of obsessive. It's big, but it's not that big. And it seems to imply that really there's something about this subject and the way it's being framed, literally composed onto the canvas, that becomes an obsessive, repetitive element in the final years of his life. So the subject is rather clear, isn't it, to us all? It's King Arthur on his deathbed. I say his deathbed advisedly because in some ways, of course, this is the last sleep of King Arthur. He's not dead, and neither is he alive. And this all goes back to those versions of King Arthur's life, that particularly goes back to Malory, and his understanding of King Arthur's last days, where King Arthur engaged in a battle with Mordred, was defeated, and was injured fatally. And then he has the vision of the hand coming out of the lake. And then the weeping queens arrive on a great bark and take him away bodily to the island of apples, of orchards, Avalon. This obviously fictional place. Now, in her very helpful notes to this painting, Alison Smith records that Burne-Jones was beginning, towards the end of his life, to refer to himself as being in Avalon, particularly in these last days, as if he had entered a kind of state like Arthur, neither dead nor alive, really, but in some kind of mythical state of suspension. So let's just look at what that suspension looked like for just a few moments. Because in terms of iconography, in terms of the way the image works, this is almost a religious painting. One sees this as a kind of pietà, the way in which a religious painting in Christian religion would have presented the dead body of Christ being wept over by his mother, the Virgin Mary. Those were paintings which always contrasted the horizontality of the figure, or the partial horizontality, because it was limp, it fell over the edges of the lap of the Virgin Mary, but it was generally a horizontal shape surmounted by a vertical one, the body of the woman presiding over that dead figure. And we have that here, except we don't have the women over the body, we don't have a female figure over the body. Actually, if we look at the composition, we see that these queens who are surrounding him are actually arranged in a circular formation. Can you see that? It's quite interesting. And this, the figure, as it were, that would complete the circle, the kind of Virgin Mary figure, really, who would be in that position, is actually replaced by a lamp. And that lamp is very like a sanctuary lamp, isn't it, above an altar. So again, this very strong religious, almost sacrilegious, actually, image is being invoked here. I guess that lamp stands in for the spirit of Arthur. As long as it's illuminated, it's telling us that he actually isn't dead. He's asleep. And this is very important in the iconography of Arthur, in his mythology, because, of course, as Malory tells us in the final chapters of the Mort d'Arthur, as his account of Arthur's life is called, Arthur is sleeping and will waken up, and when he wakens up, he will be the king of Britain again. So the suspension is an implication that he is eternal. He's a kind of god. And when he wakens and returns, England will return to a kind of Arthurian state. So the sanctuary lamp, which stands in for that missing figure, also tells us something about that narrative. Now, of course, it isn't just a composition about this horizontally placed figure, Arthur, surrounded by these feminine figures, immediately surrounded, circled by them, because we can see that the composition bleeds out to the outer edges of the canvas, and the figures have a presence a very haunting presence, actually, because they look out on either side. They look out of the picture frame. And that's a very unusual thing in painting, to distract from the center of the image in such a comprehensive way. It distracts us from the dying figure. But of course, there's a purpose to that distraction. It is, again, a narrative device. These people are, in a way, inhabiting a slightly different pictorial time. They're looking out at the world. They're looking for signs, because they know that when Arthur awakens, the world will change again. And if you look at what that world outside the immediate encampment, as it were, around Arthur, you'll see it's a very bleak world indeed. It's a world of thorns, of greyness, of mist, of what looks like a hostile landscape. And of course, that will flower again when Arthur awakens. I think particularly this green-dressed figure on the left, who's looking out anxiously. We know she's anxious because of the angle of her shoulders. We can't see the anxiety on her face, but she seems to be staring out at this bleak landscape, looking for signs, for changes. However, of course, in Avalon, everything is still in flower, and it's all in flower all at the same time, as it were, as if the season is itself in suspension. And we can look at those flowers, particularly the irises and the aquilegia, and they're just there, and they're permanent, and they're everlasting without being dried. They're not status. So this eternal springing around his body is also a sign that the spirit is still there. Now, the scale of this work, which is so different from those early works of Burne-Jones, means that the artist can produce a large painting which is in three parts, and the central part, like an altarpiece, is that dead body, and then it's flanked by these wings representing the people who are waiting for these signs and who are about to blow these great horns. These are Amazonian female figures. These great horns which they will sound when Arthur awakens. So sometimes it looks as if this is a painting in a way celebrating death, but actually it's sort of celebrating neither death nor life, a suspension, as I'm saying. Burne-Jones was deeply friendly with William Morris, who had been his undergraduate friend and who had worked with him and Rossetti on the Students' Union, as I would like to call it, the Oxford Union buildings. As a muralist, this was their first experience of a real artist, and they joined in this painting, the life of Arthur and the Holy Grail, on the walls of this student building. For a long time, Burne-Jones was dominated by Rossetti's example. And even while he was painting this in his very last days, he would turn to his studio assistant, Matthew Rook, whom he called Rookie, which is a very nice, affectionate thing. One can imagine Burne-Jones. He would say, "Rookie, what would Rossetti have thought of this?" And he really thought that Rossetti could have sorted out some of the pictorial problems that he was experiencing. And you see, there's lots of room for lots of pictorial problems. I don't think Rossetti was the kind of technician who would have helped him with these technical problems, quite honestly. And by this time, Burne-Jones was a much more significant technician than Rossetti had ever been, really. But it's interesting, he had a technical assistant to help him with these works. But there are still Rossettian elements in this work. One thinks of the attention to detail about costume and accessory, which was what was obsessed Rossetti when they first met. Rossetti was working on not just these Arthurian murals in Oxford, but in a series of very brightly colored watercolors. And some of them here in the Tate, I don't think any of them are actually on show at the moment. But these were had many details of costume, very brightly colored heraldic devices. They also eventually contained medieval musical instruments too. So some of those elements have crept in a whole generation later into Burne-Jones' work. They've become a second nature to him, and often we associate them more with Burne-Jones than we do with Rossetti. But the other thing that had obsessed Morris and Burne-Jones as undergraduates was medieval illustration and the stories of medieval romance. Indeed, Morris started building up a library of medieval manuscripts when they were very young indeed. He was a wealthy young man. And one can see some of the elements of that creeping in too, particularly in these painted irises, which act as a kind of almost decorative border, almost like a manuscript border. Can you see what I mean here? They're like the illuminated border to a great text. So there is a very interesting textual and poetic element to this visual work. But certainly by this stage, Burne-Jones had become somewhat jaded with Morris's big socialist agenda. Morris, of course, continued to be interested in the Middle Ages, and this informed deeply his attitude to the arts and crafts movement, to the role of arts in the world. And one really feels at this stage, and from these conversations that he had with his studio assistant, which are all contained in a book called Burne-Jones Talking, and it's a very, very interesting book, now out of print, but actually I recommend it to anyone I ever meet, including all of you, that there was no political agenda to Burne-Jones. If there had been, it really had evaporated by this stage. And indeed, I think that we can see that the kind of art that he's putting forward here, while it is poetic and illustrative, is actually deeply personal. It is about the primacy of art and love and emotion in his life. And so this departs from a Mauritian Middle Ages, and it departs also from his very first interest in these tiny illuminated works. The scale of the work then is important because it brings together themes of his life and it memorializes them. So when the work was shown the year after his death, it was shown with this plaque, which commemorates not only that this work is about the death of Arthur, but actually also is the last work before the death of the artist himself. Thank you.
Well, God, it's so loud. Thank you so much, Colin. I'm afraid we're going to have to take away the speaker and microphone for a next talk, but am I right in saying that...
Yes, I'm quite willing that, and I think I'm more audible without the microphone. I'm quite willing to answer questions or to talk to you if you want to talk about this.
Thanks.
Thank you again.